Daniel chapter 5. Last time, at the conclusion of Daniel chapter 4, we saw the conversion of King Nebuchadnezzar. That entire chapter is in truth the account of this great king and a great tyrant as well, who ruled the empire unopposed and at times with tremendous harshness. Consider the so-called wise men he summoned in the second chapter of Daniel so that they would explain his dream to him and interpret its meaning. When they could not do so, he simply ordered them slain. No one dared say, "Excuse me, King, but you just can't kill people." To the contrary, the opposite is true, as the order to kill all the wise men, the astrologers, magicians, sorcerers, and the Chaldeans immediately went out and was being carried out when Daniel was allowed by God to interpose himself. And not only did it save Daniel and his friends, but also the so-called assembly of wise men in the king's court when Daniel and his friends prayed. And as we know, Daniel was allowed by God to tell Nebuchadnezzar his dream and explain its meaning. That very thing saved not just Daniel and his friends, but also it saved the magicians, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers from the king's hand, who would have had them destroyed. Daniel was able to tell the king exactly what he, Nebuchadnezzar, saw in his dream and what the dream and the image in it represented. Daniel chapter 2, verse 31 says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome." The King James Version used the word terrible in place of awesome, and it presents a clearer understanding, I believe. It's an Aramaic word meaning to make afraid, or to cause to be afraid, or to terrify. And if you recall the biblical account in Daniel, it says that it caused the king's sleep to flee from him. This dream was troubling to the point that it would not let him alone, not allowing him to sleep, nor would it leave him alone even in his waking hours. Once Daniel interpreted the dream and the meaning of the image representing Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, as well as the kingdoms that would follow in the course of the world's history. By the way, all of those kingdoms have come and gone just as the Bible said they would, except the last of the Gentile world powers, which is likely in the making today amid the chaos in this world before the coming of the King of Kings, who will establish his kingdom on this earth. At the time of the dream, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was on top, represented by the head of fine gold. Then it seemed Nebuchadnezzar's thoughts transitioned from fear of this image to it becoming a source of pride for Nebuchadnezzar. And as we saw in the previous chapters, he even erected a copy of the image and demanded that everyone should worship it. The account continues in chapter 3 when Nebuchadnezzar had this huge idol erected and demands everybody worship it, and naturally, Daniel's friends refuse. And not in an arrogant sense. They simply do not worship this idol, and with haste, Nebuchadnezzar's wise men go to him, and it's here that they make their play. "There are certain Jews," Daniel 3:12 tells us, "whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up." Well, I mentioned this before in one of our previous studies, and I'll just mention it again because it's amazing, in that you would think that these guys running to Nebuchadnezzar to snitch off these three Hebrew men would instead be grateful for them and their belief in the true and living God, considering were it not for these certain Jews, they would have suffered a violent death at the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar had not these same Hebrew men, these certain Jews, along with Daniel, prayed that God would give Daniel the interpretation of the dream. thus averting the death sentence for the king's wise men, who proved to be not so wise. Continuing, the Bible tells us these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, will not worship the idol under penalty of death, and they are thrown into the fiery furnace. Suddenly a fourth man appears with them in the fire, and Nebuchadnezzar says in chapter 3, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, 'Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' 'Look,' he answered, 'I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God.'" So chapter 3 concludes with the three men, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or better known in our text as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Babylonian names that were given to them. Chapter 3 concludes with these three men being delivered from Nebuchadnezzar's hand and the fiery furnace in a way that is unmistakable, and Nebuchadnezzar does recognize that, proclaiming at the end of chapter 3, "Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, 'Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." And we continue in chapter 4. And we saw how that although Nebuchadnezzar made proclamations recognizing the true and living God of the Bible, he didn't submit himself or humble himself before him, before the living God. Then in chapter 4 comes yet another dream, the dream of the tree representing the kingdom and the decree to chop it down, and the interpretation by Daniel that the tree was actually a type figure or a symbol for Nebuchadnezzar, and the kingdom was going to be taken from him. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar was the tree to be chopped down. And hearing all this, did he then humble himself before God? No. And you would think that after the evidences that he had, the interpretation of the two dreams and the fiery furnace, that he would yield, that he would yield to the living God. But he doesn't, even though he had these ample proofs or these ample evidences. He was told by Daniel in the dream's interpretation, "They shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses." Daniel even told him, "Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity." In other words, Daniel was telling him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, this is serious. You need to wise up." But he didn't. And 12 months passed, and the Bible tells us, at the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you." That very hour, the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. Just a side note about that, but he says that he lifted his eyes to the heaven, and my understanding returned to me, Nebuchadnezzar says. And it just makes me think that maybe we need to take less counsel from the worldly venues that we have. And when we're looking for reason or wisdom, we need to lift our eyes to the heavens. The book of James, chapter 1, verse 5 says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him." And when you think about that, I mean, where does wisdom reside? It resides with the Lord. It resides with our God. So here we see a confirmation of that in Nebuchadnezzar, as he says, "And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?' At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice. And those who walk in pride, he is able to put down." So a great king, ruling over the world's greatest empire, both king and tyrant, and the biblical account of how God broke the pride of his heart, humiliated him, humbled him to the point of saving him. A picture of God's grace, really beyond our imaginations, a grace that is so determined. And in chapter 4, we have definitive clarification, events that leave no doubt as to who is really in charge and who is at work in the affairs of nations and men. Now, chapter 5. A big party, handwriting on the wall, another interpretation by Daniel, and the prophetic word concerning the fall of Babylon, and the fulfillment of the prophecy that very night. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 1. "Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have held, to subdue nations before him, and loose the armor of kings, to open before him the double doors, so that the gates will not be shut." Isaiah prophesied of Cyrus and his coming and God's plan for him 200 years before his birth. And beginning chapter 5 of Daniel, Cyrus is very near the gates of Babylon, along with the Medes and the Persian army. Chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. 20 years has passed since Nebuchadnezzar's proclamation or his declaration of faith. In 561 BC, King Nebuchadnezzar died. His son, Evil Merodach, succeeded him. Evil Merodach is mentioned in both 2 Kings and in Jeremiah. He only ruled for 2 years because his brother-in-law, Nergal Sharezer, who was married to one of Nebuchadnezzar's daughters, murdered Merodach and replaced him on the throne. This is now 559 BC. Nergal-Sharezer was eventually succeeded by his son, and this son was also murdered by another of Nebuchadnezzar's daughter's husbands. Rough bunch. His name is Nabonidus. In the strict sense, Nabonidus was the last ruler of the Babylonian Empire. He was a soldier more than anything else, and much of his time was spent on foreign expeditions. So his son, called Belshazzar, who was actually Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, was left to run the empire. He was left behind to mind the store, so to speak. And this is an important point from a prophetic perspective. The measure of the kingdom's longevity was Nebuchadnezzar and his son and his son's son, as prophesied by Jeremiah. In Jeremiah chapter 27, verses 6 and 7, we read, "And now I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and the beast of the field I have also given him to serve him. So all nations shall serve him and his son and his son's son until the time of his land comes, and then many nations and great kings shall make him serve them." Another observation of my own is derived from the historical writers. Secular history, archaeology, different historical writings paint Nebuchadnezzar as a soldier and a military planner. Long before he became king upon the death of his own father, he is credited with being a mountain fighter before Babylon gained the prominence it held when he was king. Historians credit him with improving the city's defenses his father began. He expanded the fortifications, he built moats, and added an additional outer defense wall. The fortified walls were immense, according to the archaeologists, and they included towers incorporated in the defense network manned by soldiers. The city's defenses were designed to withstand a prolonged siege. Food stores and even water was diverted by levees and canals into the city, diverted from the Euphrates River. And even the canals and the levees that controlled the canals and the flow of water, even those canals had gates. And some of the canals were dug for trade and commerce, as boats could navigate the Euphrates River and move goods. The city was considered to be impregnable. The city's walls built for defenses are estimated to be many stories high, and the estimates vary. But there are some who claim that the walls were as high in places as 300 feet. But to give you an idea of the city's outer wall, the outer wall extended some 15 miles around Babylon. There were fortified gates in the wall, a number of fortified gates, and just one in particular, called the Ishtar Gate, is said to be a double gate 38 feet high. Think of that, incorporated into a wall which is much higher than it. A double gate that is 38 feet high, that's nearly four stories. Nebuchadnezzar, when he became king, he saw a need for the fortifications in Babylon. And he had a very effective military which was tried and tested. Nabonidus, who was co-regent with his son Belshazzar, likely felt the same way, and he likely shared many of Nebuchadnezzar's views when it came to defense of the empire. In a real sense, they were probably good at what they did when it came to defending the kingdom. It appears, on the other hand, Belshazzar, the grandson, was a departure from his grandfather's and his father's way of thinking. Belshazzar was good at partying. He was not unaware that the Medes and the Persians were outside the city that night, but for whatever reason, he did nothing. It is suggested he thought the city was impregnable. He was wrong. Verses 2 through 6. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple, which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Verse 6, then the king's countenance changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosed, and his knees knocked against each other. Amazing what fear can do. Belshazzar likely went from drunk and laughing and yucking it up and having a great old time to being sober and terrified, more terrified than at any time in his life. This whole scene of partying while a hostile army is outside, it's reminiscent of our own age. In our own culture today, people chase after diversions in order not to face the realities of the present day. Belshazzar's reality was that a very hostile, very capable army was knocking on the door. His response? Just ignore it. Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Very, very bad idea. And verse 4 says, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. They were literally provoking God, literally provoking the living God. We see that same rebellion, that same attitude in the tribulation yet to come, when in Revelation chapter 9, verse 20, the Bible says, but the rest of mankind, who were not killed by these plagues, did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither hear, nor walk. And continuing in Revelation chapter 9, verse 21, and they did not repent of their murders, or their sorceries, or their sexual immorality, or their thefts. That word sorceries is rendered as pharmakia in the Greek, literally meaning drugs. And really, I believe, personal opinion again here, I believe that that's really equating that to drug abuse. And that could be illegal drugs, what we deem as illegal drugs, or even drugs that are sometimes prescribed by a doctor when they're not used properly and for their intended purpose. And I do think that that the two go hand in hand, that word pharmakia, and that it is sorcery. So from the time of Belshazzar and his pridefulness to the yet future days of the great tribulations, men's hearts are the same. Prideful and rebellious before God. The point is, people need to humble themselves before God now, while there is still mercy and grace for the asking, or the day will come upon the entire world, just like it came upon Belshazzar's party. Verse 7. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and he shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. The third ruler in the kingdom is what he was offering, and that's because he, Belshazzar, was already the second ruler in the kingdom. Remember, his dad, away on the military expedition, was really the first in the kingdom, and again, he and his son were acting as co-regents. Also, as a side note, some historians say that Nabonidus was really, at this point in time, in exile. There's not really a clear consensus regarding him. In any case, he was not in Babylon that night. I mean, it's just conjecture on my part. Historians, as I said, they don't really have a clear consensus as to where he was. Was he out on another military expedition with part of the army, the Babylonian army? Or some suggest that it's even possible that he struck a deal somewhere along the way with the Medes and the Persians, and he just made himself absent on that fateful night. Continuing in verses 8 through 10, "Now all the king's wise men came, and they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. The queen spoke, saying, 'O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts trouble you, nor let your countenance change.'" The queen that we're speaking of here is most likely the queen mother. Again, it's not known for certain, but she is likely Belshazzar's grandmother, King Nebuchadnezzar's widow. Some suggest, they say, and there is an argument for it, that she is actually his mother. But I believe that she is most likely, as others suggest, that she is most likely King Nebuchadnezzar's widow. And as the text reads, it seems to me that it says that the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. So apparently news traveled pretty fast, and she wasn't that far away. And so she made her presence known there in the banquet hall. And as she speaks, it appears very obvious that she is well acquainted with who Daniel is. Verse 11. "There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the Spirit of the Holy God. And in the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, astrologers, the Chaldeans, and soothsayers." Of course, she is speaking of Daniel. And she says, "and King Nebuchadnezzar, your father," while she is speaking to Belshazzar, who is really Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. This seems like it's another contradiction of sorts, but it's really not. The Eastern culture was such that the male head of the family was referred to as the father by sons, grandsons, great-grandsons, and so on. Continuing in verse 12, "Inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." Notice the queen mother here. She refers to Daniel by his Hebrew name. Even though she says the king named him Belshazzar, she continues, "Now let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." Why is that significant? I don't really know for sure, but I know it's significant because it's in the Bible, and there's nothing in the Bible that is not significant. Just my own personal opinion, I think that maybe this has a little to do with generations. And I think that it's a reminder for us, maybe a warning for us, that it doesn't take a long time for things to deteriorate. It doesn't take a long time for the truth to slip away from one generation to the next. And the next thing we know, things are upside down. Maybe like we see in our own country right now. We've talked about it before, and not just in teaching, but just in general conversation. And for those who are born in the, say, the 40s and the 1950s, and we look at the country today and we look at the culture in which we live, and it has changed dramatically. It's, in many ways, it's exactly opposite of what we were acquainted with in our youth. And we say, well, our country, in many ways, it's not even recognizable anymore. And maybe this is what this, in part, is referring to as we look at this verse, how important it is to raise up our children in the admonition of the Lord, and to not be slack in doing this, because as we look at the times in which we're living now, we can see we're in many ways we've ignored that, and in doing so, we've seen how from generation to generation, it's not too difficult to slip into apathy and ignore those lessons of the past. I personally believe that, and again, I'm qualifying this as my own opinion, but growing up in the 50s and 60s, I think that really we were living in the wake of the grace of our parents before us, and probably their parents before them. And I do believe that so much has slipped away. And I think that it's time for us as believers to look to the heavens, because that is where we find reason in our God, who is God. Verses 13 through 16. And just to preface this next verse, this Daniel that we see now in chapter 5 of Daniel, this is not the same young 17-year-old Daniel that was standing before King Nebuchadnezzar when he was first taken captive from Jerusalem. This is now a Daniel who's advanced in age. I mean, they're nearing the end of the 70-year captivity, assuming that he was maybe 17 when he was taken. That puts him around 87 years old, or in his late 80s anyway. And so this is a different Daniel that is standing this time before a young Babylonian ruler, much younger than him. And he's standing there before him under different circumstances than his very first appearance before King Nebuchadnezzar, this now present king's grandfather. Verses 13 through 16. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah?" Right there, you just want to go, did Daniel at that point in time, did he think, are you kidding me? Am I that Daniel? What Daniel do you think I am? Continuing on, he says, "Whom my father, the king, brought from Judah, I have heard of you, that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not give the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." You know, had it not been for fear, Belshazzar's fear, he probably wouldn't have tolerated Daniel's obvious contempt for him at this point. Because Daniel could see right through him. And Belshazzar, I'm just guessing, he probably knew that. But he's really between a rock and a hard spot now, and he's terrified. And when he says, here he is with the third ruler of things again, he talks about, I'll make you the third ruler in the kingdom. Again, this is because Belshazzar is already the second ruler in the kingdom. And his dad, his father, who's out on this military expedition or wherever he's at, absent at the time, he's really the first ruler. And so Daniel He spurns the gifts. He could care less about being third ruler in the kingdom. You think back when King Nebuchadnezzar was alive, he was really running the kingdom for King Nebuchadnezzar. And in the next few verses, it appears as contempt would probably be the best word to describe Daniel's feelings towards Belshazzar. Belshazzar remarks, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah?" That's incredible. I mean, he knew exactly who he was talking to. And I think that really what Belshazzar is doing in mentioning this and even bringing up his grandfather's name is, in a sense, I think he's probably name-dropping, so to speak, to make sure Daniel doesn't forget the relationship here. But in truth, Daniel knew King Nebuchadnezzar far beyond anything this ruler of Babylon could imagine. And in verses 17 through 23, Daniel lays it all out, a sermon of sorts, and likewise an indictment of Belshazzar. Verses 17 through 23. "Then Daniel answered and said before the king, 'Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation.'" Verse 18. "O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father a kingdom and majesty, glory, and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, his spirit was hardened in pride, and he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him." Verse 21. "Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. And you have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, who do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." Daniel says in verse 22, "But you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this." Romans, Paul in the book of Romans, chapter 1, verse 20. "Such it is with everyone who refuses to humble themselves before God." He writes, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." The Belshazzar mentality runs rampant in our world today, in our culture today. Verses 24 through 31. "Then the fingers of the hand were sent from him, and this writing was written, and this is the inscription that was written, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of each word, Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." Then Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 64 years old. King Cyrus, historians say King Cyrus actually entered through the gates a few days later. So as you look at the last verse, it says that very night that Belshazzar was slain and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, but in actuality King Cyrus was also there, and he entered through those gates unobstructed, just like the prophecy said he would. Whose hand was it? Personally, I think it was the hand of Jesus. I think it was Jesus that was in the furnace, and I think later we see Jesus is in the lion's den with Daniel.